take the hard line, some take none at all. Some just want their freedom, and they wind up behind prison walls. There are cops on every corner, and they know what they don't like. If you're it, then you know that the street's no place for you at night. No, 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 no.
Songs like, you know, they were kind of rowdy things, you know. When I got my band going, you know, then it was even better because, you know, it was like then a rock band, you know, with four young people on a stage dressed in tight clothing and swinging it, you know, and it was cooking. And people, you know, youth responded to it.
Roger Lucy, South African, musician.
I think that Roger and I maybe epitomize what is really the true miracle in South Africa. Is the reconciliation thing.
Paul Erasmus, South African, security police officer.
And I guess in many ways, in a strange and perverse way, our lives are kind of intertwined by the past, you know. In our own small way, I mean, let me say that, we are symbols of an era, you know, of South Africa. I think there are lots of symbols of South Africa. It's a huge, diverse, wonderful place. And we are maybe symbols of what happened to white boys.
This is a story of two men from one country. Two men born around the same time. Two men who shared a passion for music. Two men who found themselves in opposite camps. The Sound Fountain presents Enemies on Common Ground.
I look around for the traces or the signs they left behind. There's no one here who knows the faces, like a world that just went blind. The road, it just gets longer.
There's an incredibly strong tendency in South Africa at the moment, and I hate to say, but amongst a lot of white people, to forget about the past. Don't go there, we don't want to know about it. And that is a huge issue for me, because I don't believe that we can grow and progress as a nation until we confront our past, you know. You won't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been.
Where you're going to if you don't know where you've been.
I wanted to be an artist, not to be a policeman, but I started in 1975 and in 1976 as a young man of 18 years old. I had an assault rifle in my hand and I was in the middle of the Soweto riots, which kind of changed my life. I mean, I don't know how to even describe it. Even now, it was a horrendous experience for many young South Africans, or be it policemen or army members. To see violence on a scale like that, children shot dead, a whole town of millions of people just in flames, and the wanton destruction that went with it. I believe this was part of the communist plot to take over our country, the Soweto riots.
I started off being a solo performer with an acoustic guitar, and I was writing songs, and I had a firm belief that my songs needed to reflect the society that I lived in. And they ended up being songs of anger and accusing the state and the regime of atrocities. Because I felt that, you know, there was a lot of what was going on that I was privy to, that I managed to see as a young white person, that a lot of my young white compatriots, friends, colleagues weren't seeing, because black and white society was so separated at that time.
We were propagandized, if you will, or brainwashed, that our country was essential to the communist plot to rule the planet. So instead of opting out, like most young South Africans, or trying to get out of it, when I had the chance to leave, I wanted to see what was behind us. I didn't want to wear a uniform anymore and just carry this rifle around or deliver summonses. I applied to join the security branch, who were the creme de la creme of this whole thing, the intelligence service, which is a contradiction in terms, pardon my humour.
I had a little black friend, and we used to get up to no good. I mean, we used to go and smoke dope together, and we used to go into the township that he lived in to go and score the stuff often. And I became aware of how black people were living. But, you know, it was something that wasn't shown. It was something that people really didn't know, unless you made a big effort and went out and saw what was happening. So that was my, I suppose, education at a relatively early age of about 14, 15.
Some men take the hard line and some take none at all. And some just want their freedom when they wind up behind the prison walls. There are cops on every corner and they know what they don't like. And if you're rich, then you know that the street's no place for you at night. No, 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 no.
When I started in the security branch, I mean, we did very low-key things like that was part of your training, doing security clearances on people for South Africa's nuclear program, for the various embassies and stuff like that. But within a couple of months, started to get involved, registered informers. Was trained to infiltrate organizations, and I think it was possibly a year after I was first inducted into the security branch, I was given the first orders to carry out illegal activities in that. We were, as part of the police force, mind you, somewhat above the law. And the whole national mindset, the so-called lager mentality, was to get our enemies or perceived enemies out of the country. We were simply told to go out at night and terrorize these people. Initially, it started off with very innocuous little incidents like painting slogans on walls, throwing bricks through windows. And gradually it grew worse and worse and worse. We were responsible for 60% of the bombs that went off for propaganda reasons. We were setting them off to blame it on the ANC. That was another part of our job, Dirty Tricks Department.
He was a young man, only 20. Lived in Brighton Township, just outside of Port Elizabeth. In a small house with his family, he lived through violations. When a school
he was obviously seen as a threat to the state. He was somebody that could raise people's emotions, make them aware of things. He was singing about the police with the boots and the batons. He was singing about Steve Biko, a very, very sensitive point. He was singing about a death in detention, Longile Thabalazo, who fell five floors whilst under the care of my colleagues at that time in Port Elizabeth.
Well, the cops came Monday morning and they took him on suspicion of a robbery and arson. The law makes no provision, so they handed him to plain clothes, the special branch elite. And it doesn't really matter how strong you are, they got ways to make you speak. They're gonna make you speak if they really wanna hear you speaking. They're gonna get it out.
You know, the protests at that time were about the Vietnam War. We had a completely different situation. So, you know, people were singing, you know, Alice's Restaurant and, you know, one, two, three, four, what are we fighting for? You know, that sort of stuff. And I just felt that that was fine and that was good, but it didn't relate to our country and it didn't relate to our situation. And in many ways, I found it odd that the South African protest singers were putting on American accents and singing about American issues. And I wanted to say, and I was saying, hey, we've got our own issues here. Let's sing about those.
Well, whatever happened in that office, God and the cops will only know. Because the law has ways of keeping quiet so that nothing at all will show. But about 3 o'clock that same afternoon, Longili fell 5 floors. Lay dead below on the street outside. They quickly rushed his body. Carry on.
what happened with Roger is actually quite interesting, because all radio messages, radio shows were monitored either by the security branch or by the security forces. And Roger had done a show with Voice of America and sung some of his rather political songs. And I was given the job by security branch head office that received the transcript. I was given the job to identify him, which meant open a file on him and start monitoring his activities. And eventually I got hold of the record, The Road Is Much Longer, which contained some pretty radical songs, anti-regime songs. Roger actually went as far to even sing about the security branch, about us.
Look, I knew that there was a danger. You know, I knew that the security police were everywhere. There was a kind of a defiance, you know. I'd been bust a few times with dope and, you know, I'd been beaten up by the cops. You see, I didn't come at it from an academic sense. I came at it from the street. My political awakening wasn't through the head, it was through the heart. So that's where my songs came from as well, you know, and they were loud and they were full of anger. And I look at the photographs of myself at that time, you know, and I, you know, my fist in the air, and, you know, it was very emotional stuff.
I got hold of the record and actually ended up banning it, and was given instructions by a police general to make certain that Roger stopped his activities in his tracks. You could probably ask me now, what did that actually mean? All that you knew and all that we knew for many years is that the system would cover you. How far you went, although, yes, killing was never really sanctioned. But I dare say that if I had gone the whole way and physically injured Roger or something like that, they would have turned a blind eye to it. I didn't, because, well, for a lot of reasons, I don't think most of us were natural-born killers, but yeah, I certainly disrupted his shows and wrecked his career.
I think it was just a matter of time before we started getting into some serious trouble. Of course, the nature of the trouble was what was weird, because, you know, if they'd come and kicked my ass and told me that they're going to silence me, that would have been fine, but it didn't work like that.
Found out where he stayed.
It worked in a whole series of covert kind of ways.
I went to his record company, threatened them, told them that he was a communist, which was the worst sort of swear word you could label any South African with. And then
I'd arrive for a gig with all the gear.
When it came to his gigs, I would pretend to be. We always used the right wing as a convenient tool to cover up our own actions. I would phone them up and say, you got a communist appearing at your theatre on Friday night. I'm going to come there and I'm going to blow the whole place up, you know, if you let him perform.
And I'd be told that I'm not playing. So I was left with no choice but to walk away. And then occasionally I'd get told, look, you know, I don't think you should carry on playing here, but I'd play anyway. And there was one particular instance when that happened and tear gas was put through the air conditioning unit of the club.
So doors started to close to Roger.
And it went on and on. I mean, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and my house would be full of armed policemen. I can remember telling my ex-wife, you know, that that the previous night I'd woken up with my house full of policemen, and she said, oh, don't talk rubbish, you're looking for sympathy. So it became this strange, became this really strange situation.
And his music career sort of ground to a halt very quickly.
And nobody at that time ever owned up to being leaned on by the police.
The postal and telephone monitoring system in South Africa, I think, made the KGB and oppressive Russia look like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
They intercepted my post, they intercepted my telephone.
The letters were opened, steamed open, and copied, and then analysed, and at times just thrown away or trashed.
So invitations to play at places, I believe there were even invitations to go and play in England and the States, were just thrown into the bin.
And it certainly worked in his case, because Roger never brought out any more songs like Lungile Tabalazi. He was just simply closed down all the way down the line.
I lost all self-confidence. My marriage disintegrated rapidly. Things fell apart on all fronts. I ended up with a terrible, terrible drug problem. I mean, I was incredibly vulnerable at the time. I had no money. I was, you know, just, I mean, it all just collapsed very, very quickly. And I had to go and live with my mom in Durban, and she sort of helped me through it. And then I went back to Johannesburg. And, you know, the first job that I did was a guy who ran a venue where I used to play gave me the job as a barman. So I went from being the star of the place to being the barman in the venue, which was a very, very humbling experience. And also one where I had to, you know, bite my lip as people would gloat over my demise.
Did you ever physically hurt anyone?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I did.
Did you ever physically hurt Roger Luthi?
No. No, I never hurt Roger. But I was part of torturing, especially on the border. But that was a war situation. It was terrible. But I was unfortunately part of it.
The more I got hammered, I think the more I just became unable to compromise. The idea of compromise was deeply distasteful. It was that would have been a defeat. To have come out and sung songs about roses and wine would have just been really, that would have humiliated me. I think that would have hurt me much more than the compromise that I finally did make, which was to walk away from music.
Memories hang like spiders suspended in thin air. Strangers' faces fill my nights and the dreams go wild out there. Like a runaway on a desert island. I'm a runaway on a tiny island.
Slowly, Roger Luthi reconstructed his life. He became a television sound engineer, moved into journalism. Ironically, the musician who had been denied an audience became well known to South Africans as a TV journalist, reporting on the worst conflicts around Africa and Europe. He'd finally got himself out of his drug habit, was earning a steady income, and had even achieved a level of fame and success. But he wasn't happy.
And it was very, very, very difficult for me. And I'll tell you what the difficulty was. It was, as a musician, I was a spokesperson. I had a voice. As a journalist, I didn't. I had to be seen to be objective. So that was the hardest part for me, to see my country burning, and all I could do was stand and point a camera at it.
But what Roger Luthi didn't know at this low point in his life was that the message of his music was in fact beginning to have an effect in an unexpected quarter.
Secretly, I became Roger's biggest fan. So after transcribing him, the music just grew on me. I mean, this guy was amazing. I'm still today one of Roger's biggest fans. As crazy as it sounds. I mean, those years I could never admit it, but I often used to play his tapes when we'd go out on raids and it.
Yeah, that's one of those strange, strange things. Look, there's a whole lot of things about me and Paul Erasmus that are strange and weird. And where do I start by even trying to describe that feeling of knowing, you know, our history? But being able, you know, I have put it behind me. And a lot of my friends say to me, God, you must want to punch him. And I actually don't, you know. I just don't. In fact, we can talk like as friends almost. I don't know if friends is the right word, but I do have a respect for him.
I think it came home to us in 1988 that we weren't going to win anything. We certainly weren't going to win militarily. We were tired. I remember at the time I had this terrible fatigue sort of descended over all of us. We were losing the battle on a scale that we certainly couldn't handle. I mean, how many people could we arrest, detain, lock up, torture? How could you stop this? That was the year that a lot of changes came about, certainly in my case. I wanted to get out of the system. In fact, I started a business then and tried to leave, but I had too much knowledge. And I would have then, if I had left, become a threat to them. There's no secret that our colleagues were sent against us. The Motherwell bombing in Port Elizabeth, in which two policemen were killed, and the ANC was blamed, was to shut the one policeman up. The guy was seen as a threat. And that happened to me in 1991, where a colleague of mine was sent to blow me and those two children and my ex-wife to pieces. And when that happened, when I became a threat to the people that I'd served so faithfully for many years, I thought, to hell with it. And that's where my big change came in life. I decided that I'm going to fight this out.
I only discovered, I think, 13 years after it had all fallen apart. And I discovered by reading an excerpt of Paul Erasmus's book in a local newspaper in South Africa. So it was a huge moment when I finally saw that, because in many ways it was shocking, but in so many other ways it was a great, great relief. I was finally able to start putting the past behind me, which I'd never been able to do because I didn't know what the past was. I'd no idea what had happened. I knew something had happened, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
I'd left the police force, suffering from post-traumatic stress in and out of hospital, but handling things. I didn't want to know about any of this. I just blotted it all out. And then Judge Goldstone and the Goldstone Commission came along, and one of my former colleagues started to talk, and there was the domino effect. He implicated the next one, and I was the fourth person on the list. So I made a choice at that time. I mean, it was either try and see this thing through, hide, which was impossible. I mean, where could we go? Anywhere in the world, I would have been recognized, or somewhere along the line. And yeah, we approached the Goldstone Commission and I agreed to talk, and was then taken out of South Africa because my life and my family's life was in danger, in severe danger. And I was brought to Denmark and ended up living in England on a witness protection program.
I think that he did a brave thing by coming out and revealing, you know, this all of the stuff. And God knows it's helped me reconstruct my life.
I come from a reasonably conservative Afrikaans family. And yeah, I've been pretty much excommunicated by many people in my own family. My ex-wife's family being Afrikaans as well, the same phenomena applied. So I just keep a low profile. I'm a single parent. I look after my son. I've got custody of my child. But yeah, life goes on. I've got no real fear of anybody. I mean, I believe in the biblical thing. You know, it's become my maxim for many years, Luke 11, the truth will set you free. I mean, that's it. If I tell the truth, I mean, what must I fear?
I managed to leave the television news business. I started doing things that I wanted to do. I started playing music again properly. And I also, very, very importantly, bought a little piece of land, a bit of reserve out in the mountains outside of Cape Town. And I built a little house with my own hands out of used materials, out of old windows and doors that I'd bought from scrapyards. And it was a deeply healing process because I'd obviously been to psychotherapy before then because, you know, one goes really, really nuts after an event like that. And it took about 8 months. But it was all to do with the stuff of going through what had happened, how it happened, you know, and also imagining what must have happened to Paul Erasmus, you know, because I started thinking, you know, I mean, he must have had a hell of a life as well, you know. The guilt, the pain, the terrible poison that he must have had to carry and live with in his life. So it became a long process for me, you know, every day working out in that hot African sun. These were all part of the processes that have kind of brought me to where I am now.
Some of us went to jail. Half of my former colleagues are either dead, or they're in lunatic asylums, or they've got drug problems, or they're alcoholics, committed suicide. I mean, that's the legacy that was left to us. But our political masters or whatever, no responsibility, nothing.
The fact of the matter was that we were two different people on two sides of a war. But he also was a victim, you know. He was a young guy that got, like so many of my friends as well, you know, that bought into that story. The communists are going to come and take over our country. They're going to come and rape our daughters and kill our wives. And, you know, they're going to do what they did in the Congo. And, you know, that people forget that very quickly. But those stories, those roles were huge in young white people's lives. And they were dangerous. They were terrifying. And people forget that.
I was hospitalized. I took antidepressants on a scale that you couldn't believe. I was hospitalized 14 times, so-called post-traumatic stress. Most of my colleagues, in fact, hundreds of us, if not thousands, have gone down that same road.
We both still carry a lot of stuff, you know. I think he's got it harder than me at the moment. I think he's done a very brave thing.
I do feel good being part of something that's like reconciliatory, or maybe playing a positive role in it. But I really don't believe that I could ever totally forgive myself. You just can't. I mean, just the scope of the whole thing, the magnitude of what I was involved in alone, I mean, I will carry that burden for the rest of my life. But it's when you get into bed at night and you close your eyes, that's when it catches up on you. I mean, you can't get away from it. You can't run away from yourself. I tried with drugs, the times I drank myself into oblivion. Contemplated suicide. A lot of my friends committed suicide. Colleagues committed suicide. You just can't live with yourself. But, yeah, I'm trying.
You know, I could have been a huge rock star, but I'm not. But what I am is something else, you know, and it's... I don't have huge financial success, but I've had a wonderful, wonderful life of much diversity. And I've done things that have brought me deep satisfaction. And look, the other thing is that I could have been a failed musician. You know, I could have been somebody that just went and carried on and never really cracked it. And I mean, that would have been a hell of a lot worse. So I think what I've got is great and wonderful and marvelous. And it continues.
I think if you listen to Roger's songs, I find it very hard to listen to Longile Tabalazi, but The Road is much longer. That actual song now has particular relevance in my life. And you know, there was a time that I nearly died from post-traumatic stress. I was taking drugs and all sorts of stuff. And I often used to think about it, just those words, you know. I had to heal and come back because the road was much longer, you know.
I feel a peculiar warmth towards him when I see him. And I know that that's going to freak a lot of people out and they're going to hate me for saying that. But that's what I feel. Maybe it's a sort of a bond, you know, that bond of two enemies that have been forced to find common ground. And I believe that he's been through a lot. I think he's been through a hell of a hard time. He's been shunned by his colleagues and his friends. He's been shunned by his victims. You know, he's raising a child who has severe education problems on his own. You know, his life hasn't been easy. He's really had to pick himself up from rock bottom. It's not sympathy, though. I mean, that's not the warmth. I think it's just the fact that maybe what it really is the fact that his revelation has enabled me to put my life back together from a very shocking place.
Riding high, there you go. Will I touch you? Where you've been or where you go, and I'm still hanging, and I want you to know that the highway is just like a prison. From where I'm standing, there's no space that's near. One thing only that's certain, that the road is much longer than ever before. That the road is much longer than ever before. That the road is much longer.
I can't sing it. It's 25 years old, for God's sake. You know, it's, I mean, I don't do that stuff anymore.
Roger Lucey and Paul Erasmus featuring In Enemies on Common Ground. The program was produced and presented for The Sound Fountain by Dira Sujan. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.